And tonight with Greg Little, we go searching for Atlantis. I'm looking forward to this. So that's next on Coast to Coast AM. Dr. Greg Little, psychologist turned explorer and documentary maker since 2003. Greg and his wife, Laura, have been actively searching the Bahamas for archaeological ruins that might be linked to Atlantis, working with the Edgar Cayce Organization in the Search for Atlantis project with some new updates and discoveries. And here he is for a complete program tonight on Coast to Coast, Greg Little. Gregory, welcome back.
Well, thank you, George. It's always a pleasure to be here, and my gosh, do we have a lot of ground to cover.
Looking forward. How's family? Everybody okay?
Oh, yes. Everybody's good.
Super. So, you know what? That makes life easier, doesn't it?
Yes, it does. It does. We even took my 84-year-old father into the Bahamas to identify some crashed planes that we'd found.
I love it. You know, we were last on together almost 2 years ago, almost 2 years to the month. It was August of 2007, I think, and lots have changed. Tell me a little bit about what you've been doing. Just update myself about you.
Well, actually, when I was on before, one of the things you pressed me on was what was happening in Egypt, and I really couldn't say.
You held back that night.
Well, I had to. There's been a lot going on. The past 2 years has been just incredibly busy, and there's a real mystery that's unfolding here, actually being solved on a lot of different fronts. We've been involved in, of course, searching the Bahamas. We've found numerous, 14 planes altogether, and gotten involved in making a number of documentaries for various networks on the Bermuda Triangle, which are about to show. And then we found some, been involved in really researching and trying to document some structures that are at Bimini that do appear to be buildings on the 10,000 BC shoreline. And then I've been involved in some of the work in Egypt, and there's big news there under the Sphinx and in that area around where the pyramids are. And
okay.
The search for Cayce's Hall of Records is moving pretty rapidly, and a lot of other things are happening. Cayce's statements about the mounds. I finished a mound encyclopedia, which I actually started in 1982. Long project. So I spent the last year basically finishing that book, which was a monstrous project. And then we did a tour last week and had some strange things happen and discovered some things that were supposedly destroyed in America, which are still there, which directly relate to Atlantis also.
Well, we're going to have our plate full tonight then, aren't we?
Oh, yes.
Let's talk a little bit about this Egyptian situation when you were on with me. I think you were talking about Andrew Collins at that time, but you couldn't say too much. So tell me what's happening there.
Well, I really couldn't say much about it at all, and I didn't know even how to respond to you. I just said I don't even remember what I said. I think
you said no comment. No, I'm kidding.
Yeah, I think I did say so. I didn't want to tell an untruth, but I really couldn't say anything else. Basically, back I believe it's 2006, Andrew Collins published a book. He's a British author, pretty well known. Wrote a book called Gateway to Atlantis and numerous other books. But Andrew published a book called The Cygnus Mystery, and it was about the Cygnus constellation, which is best known as the Northern Cross.
Mm-hmm.
One of the things that Andrew found in that book, I mean, it's a huge book, as many of these British authors' books are, very well documented, lots of details in it. But one of the things in that book that Andrew had was that the Cygnus constellation could be placed right on top of the pyramids at Giza. Better than the Orion constellation. I'm sure. I know you've had shows on that, and that's all very interesting. And that started kind of a controversy of, is it Cygnus or is it Orion that the pyramids were built on in terms of to symbolize these constellations? But in any event, the problem with Orion is it didn't fit as well as Cygnus. But the other thing is, other than the idea that the pyramids were built to the belt of Orion, it really hadn't led to any other discoveries. Now, with Andrew's idea, which actually was discovered by an engineer by accident, and Andrew included his work in his book, with Andrew's idea, there were many other stars in Cygnus. And a number of us got interested in where do these other stars fit there? Is there anything else there? Is it just another coincidence? So Andrew started doing work on trying to figure out what the other stars of the Cygnus constellation, where they would fall. One of the places that he found was near a well on a hill, which Edgar Cayce talked about a mound that was undiscovered at Giza, where the three pyramids are. And there's a large hill that's called Gebel Ghibli. And it has, right below it, it has a Muslim cemetery. And within that cemetery, there is a well. And that well is protected. Andrew managed to get into the well and managed to find out that there were tunnels from that well. And that's on the side where the Sphinx is. But the problem was there were other stars of Cygnus, particularly the one that's the brightest star of that constellation called Deneb. And Andrew wondered what was under Deneb. And he went there and he really looked around, but he couldn't find anything. And the suggestion was then made to him that perhaps it's an entrance somewhere under the surface. He then returned to Giza, looked around, and then the ARE sponsored more research with him, a couple of expeditions that he went with an Egyptologist, Nigel Skinner Simpson, who went along with him and his wife. They managed to enter this tomb, which is very close to where Deneb would lay on the ground if the three main stars were on the pyramids. And Cygnus, by the way, is a bird.
Okay.
Particularly a swan. So it's a constellation of a swan. The Native Americans called it a cross. So when he went into this site, he really, this tomb, he looked around. It was a large tomb and couldn't really find anything. And then this Egyptologist, who's from England, found in the British Museum some material from a fellow who had been the British consul to Egypt back in the late 1700s, early 1800s. His name was Henry Salt. And it was actually in his memoirs. And Salt had entered this tomb and claimed to have found a tunnel entrance, a cave entrance, that led to basically a labyrinth of other tunnels and some huge chambers. He didn't explore the whole thing, and he was with a pretty famous Italian by the name of Caviglia. And that was it. That's all they wrote about it. They went in, it got really dark, they went in several hundred yards, and they turned around and came back out.
Oh, my. Okay.
All right. So, but that has been lost. That journal was, like, lost. Nobody knew about it. So in that, Andrew said, my God, he found out where this particular tomb was, and it's known as the Tomb of the Birds. It is on the opposite side of the pyramid field on the west side, whereas the Sphinx is on the east. Very few people go to the west side. In fact, this area is closed off. Andrew then and his wife and the Egyptologist, Nigel Skinner, got some camels, went over. Now, they didn't have permission from the Egyptian authorities to do this.
Oh, that's not going to make Zahi Hawass happy,
well,
is
Zahi,
it?
Well, Zahi is aware of all this now. What they did is it's not illegal. They got permission when they reached the site to look at it as tourists. And when Andrew had first gone in, they saw nothing. And he went in again into this big tomb looking for an opening. And they looked all around, and he couldn't find it. And then kind of as a last thing, he sort of looked up, and above this sort of a shelf or a niche, there was a crack. It looked like a crack. And he got up and looked in it, and it opened up into a massive opening on the inside. And he stuck his head in. It was stale. And then a whole bunch of bats came out. He and his wife then went in. It was pitch black. They went through this opening, went into this cave system, and they walked for a distance, and it was like there was no oxygen in the room. It was stale. Well,
I could see that, yeah.
And they could hear a lot of bats moving. They didn't have any flashlights. They were totally unprepared for this. They never thought they'd actually find it.
What were they going in with? A lighter, maybe, just for a little light?
Well, they were using flash cameras, and they took a lot of photographs.
Oh, my.
And so, you know, you'd get the flash every now and then so they could see, but they got worried that, well, maybe there's some holes, some shafts that go straight down. So they took a lot of photos. They then returned to England immediately. I mean, Andrew called me basically while they were there, and he called the main people at the ARE and said, we have found this thing. They went back again and actually had more light while they were there. They got a flashlight.
Try to do it the right way this time.
Well, huh? This is still during that first trip. And then he went one more time, which the ARE funded, and they wound up taking some breathing apparatus full because the cave had bats in it. There's a disease called histoplasmosis that bats carry. It's in their droppings. So you have to be very cautious. So they had some breathing apparatus. They had toxic outfits on that could, like hazmat outfits, and they had some breathing material and good lights, which, of course, the British call torches. So they wound up going in several hundred yards, but it was just was hot. The oxygen level was low, and they got to where some of the works that they've read about in the SALT journals, they called them syringes, which is like a tube. And I've actually seen some of those in the Bahamas where you go into these caves and then they narrow down to a tube that you have to crawl through. And in some of those tubes, when they were crawling through those, they basically stopped because they saw what are known as white widow spiders. These are basically the same thing as a black widow spider, but they never see the light of day. So they are albino widow spiders. So they stopped, got several hundred photographs, I'd say 400 photos, very impressive. There are areas of this system that are very clearly cut by man. Other areas are caves, enormous caves with roofs 20, 30 feet in some cases, room size openings. And they decided they would not explore it all the way to the end because they weren't prepared to do it all the way. And they knew at that point, well, the Egyptian authorities have to get involved in this. So this was found because it lied, or the opening was exactly where one of the stars of Cygnus, Deneb, which is the brightest star, it was there. And it did follow what this guy Henry Salt wrote in his journal, and it goes toward the pyramids, and it splits off. There are actually several tunnels. They followed several of these. There's at least three of them that go to large chambers, and then the tunnels and caves go on, and they may actually go all the way to the pyramids and the Sphinx and actually that well on the other side.
Now, when they were doing this originally, you said Zahi Hawass knows about it.
Well,
now.
He didn't know about it.
He didn't know it then. How do you hide that from him? He's everywhere.
Well, no, he can't be everywhere. He's not one of those computer brains like you talked about the last hour, which is very interesting, by the way.
Yeah.
But Zahi can't be everywhere. It's an enormous area. He does know about it now. The ARE notified him about this. And a number of us had talked about it beforehand. What's he going to say? And we all decided what he's going to say is, well, we know about this. We've known about this all along.
Right.
And
right.
That is the case. That's what he said initially. And then one of the main people in the ARE met with him privately before Andrew went and met with him privately too. But before Andrew met, the ARE official laid out some of the photos. And Zahi kind of did a double take and said, no, we don't know about this. Now, when Andrew came in sometime later, he did say that he knew about it and it was written up. And so Andrew asked him, well, where is this? Because Andrew had really looked at every single thing written about it. It's not on the main layout of Giza. It's not on Mark Lerner's map of everything that's ever been found there. It's not on anything, and it appears to have been forgotten. Something found in the very early 1800s and then forgotten.
And do you think it still winds its way around, or did they get to the
They
to
did
the
not
end?
Get to the end because it narrowed down, and they saw the spiders. They were not prepared for those.
No,
they,
I don't
they
blame
could hear
them.
Probably. I think what they heard were more bats, but it just kind of spooked them. I mean, it is pitch black in this place.
Oh, man.
There's virtually no light, and the air is very stale. Somebody that goes in all the way, that you're going to have oxygen.
Absolutely, and lights and everything else. And
they had the lights, and they were prepared for all that, and they got in a long way. But what Andrew did is absolutely remarkable. It may well lead to Casey's Hall of Records. That is distinctly possible. It makes sense with the Cygnus overlay on Giza. And all this is written up in a book which will actually not come out until September, and it's called Beneath the Pyramids. We've posted an article on our website about it with one photo of Andrew standing in one of the large areas, and I know that's on our website.
If the Hall of Records are there, Greg, and we're going to get into Atlantis and all that in just a moment, but if the Hall of Records are there, and I believe Casey said they were in three locations, Bimini, Central America, and then near the base of the Sphinx.
Right.
What do you think is in the Hall of Records?
Well, we know what Casey said was in it. Casey said that there are 32 stone tablets containing the history of humanity from the very beginning until the demise of Atlantis.
Would it echo Genesis, do you think?
Well, Casey's story is somewhat similar. I mean, you could take Genesis, and Casey actually says, you know, Genesis really doesn't say a lot, you know. God created the heavens and the earth, and that's kind of it.
I mean, the first open parts, that's the best, you know.
Yes, yes. But I think it would fit what Genesis tells us, the little bit that Genesis tells us. But the Atlanteans, we know Casey's given us some of the story that were on these 32 tablets, and supposedly the Atlanteans began when their consciousness reached the point to where they could write their story. They wrote that everything was basically spiritual in nature, and spirit forced its way or involuted into matter. And it was a conscious choice that our spirit, whatever that is, or our energy, decided to enter matter because it's a different kind of a realm, and it was a level of experience. And from that point on, then evolution obviously occurred, because Casey talked about the different root races that developed and different manifestations of humans.
What about artifacts, flying vehicles, anything that might have been of high technology? Might they be down there too?
Well, according to Casey, there are some that they have left some weapons and tools. But what Casey says they've actually left are the instructions for those. In those tablets and somewhere else in the Hall of Records are the instructions for all of these high-tech,
almost like blueprints,
esoteric devices.
Huh. Maybe given to them?
The really interesting thing in this, and this, you know, we're actually probably going to talk about crop circles here too. The interesting thing is that the people involved in the whole crop circle search, and Andrew's one involved in that, and the Aries getting into all these interesting areas now, like crop circles. Casey didn't talk about crop circles, but what Casey did say is that when the Atlanteans decided to form these three Hall of Records, the reason they did it was that there was a particular priest who got some sort of communication from higher intelligences, clearly not of earthly origin. And these intelligences told this priest that Atlantis was going to be destroyed, and gave this priest the plan to preserve the records of humanity. So there was a higher intelligence involved, and that appears to be the same thing, at least the thing that Andrew says, and what I've also said in my books about the crop circles, that even though probably most of the current ones are probably made by human hands, these people say, and Andrew lives in the midst of them and has interviewed them, these people say that they believe they're being led by some higher intelligence.
What if they were time travelers, Greg?
That's another interesting point, but I can't, you know, I don't know what to say about that.
Okay, when we come back, we'll talk about Edgar Casey's organization. Edgar Casey fascinates me. He always does. He's been called the Great American Prophet. We'll be back in a moment with Greg Little on Coast to Coast AM. Well, when you sign up for Streamlink by going to coasttocoastam.com, you will now find that in addition to podcasting and all the other goodies, you're going to be able to download past programs, 1 year's worth of archives now, and it'll even get even better. It's a great deal. Pennies a day. It's a great way to augment what you do with your favorite radio station. Streamlink, part of Coast to Coast AM. And welcome back to Coast. I'm George Norrie. Gregory Little, our guest tonight. Gregory, to talk about Edgar Casey and really understand Atlantis, we also need to talk about his organization, the Association for Research and Enlightenment. Did he form that, or did that get formed after he passed on?
Well, there was an organization before he died, and the organization was one of spirituality, enlightenment also. But yeah, there was an organization. He helped build a hospital, which failed in the Depression then. I mean, it was in a very bad time that all this took place with Casey. But there was an organization, and the ARE, though, really, which is the Association for Research and Enlightenment, and I just use the term ARE, but the ARE has become a very large organization, and it wasn't nearly that large when Casey was alive. I'm not sure how many members it really had, but it couldn't have been in the thousands. It was probably 400 or 500 at the time of his death.
I love it. It's a great organization. I mean, and I you know, I'm really into alternative medicine, Greg. So I go there and I look at the Edgar Casey remedies, and it's fascinating.
They really are. It's amazing how many people and how many physicians are in the organization and how many of them use these remedies. There are protocols for all sorts of diseases. The protocols are based on what Casey said the basic treatment was for all of these different diseases. But he also said that it depends upon the individual. You just can't take one treatment and apply it to everybody that has the same disease. It depended upon the individual's body. But there are a huge number of physicians in the organization. You know, some people will portray it as a sort of far out there organization that is, they use the term New Age, they like to throw that out and talk about it being preposterous, but they don't realize the number of professionals in the organization, everything from physicians to nurses, all different people in the medical field, psychologists, you name it, educators. There's probably as many MDs and PhDs and various professionals as in any other organization, and it's a large organization.
The Casey readings, for us, of course, even if there's one person who just hasn't heard of him, most of us have. Explain a little bit about Edgar Casey and these trance-like readings that he would do.
Well, you know, Casey was born in 1877 in Hopkinsville, Kentucky. You always hear that when anybody wants to describe Casey. The thing that you have to remember is in 1877, there wasn't a lot of medical treatment. It was very crude then. The other thing is this. Hypnosis was actually a very, very new thing, and it started out being known as mesmerism. And what happened was Casey had an ailment, and his ailment was he lost his voice. And a stage hypnotist came into Hopkinsville, and Casey's friends encouraged him to go up on the stage. He was hypnotized on stage, and he was able to speak. Everybody was shocked because he had voice paralysis. Later, under hypnotic trance, Casey actually was asked by the hypnotist what was wrong with him. And he said, here's what's wrong with the body. And he then told the hypnotist, make a suggestion to Edgar Casey. Of course, this is Casey's voice speaking, but make a suggestion to Edgar Casey to increase the flow of blood around the neck and the throat. Well, the hypnotist was kind of stunned by it, but he did it. He said, increase the amount of blood flow to the neck and the throat. He did. Everybody watched this. It got blood red. Casey then was brought out of the hypnotic trance by the hypnotist. He spit some blood out, and then he could talk. And that's really where it started. Some local physicians got interested in this. They had heard about it. It actually made the newspaper that here's this guy that everybody liked who could now talk. And some physicians then tried hypnosis on him and decided that, well, if he could heal himself, maybe he can heal others. So they would hypnotize Casey and then ask him questions about other people. And he had total amnesia when he came out of the hypnotic trance about what he'd said. And he often was, you know, he'd ask him, what did I say? What did I say? But in these hypnotic trances, they would describe an individual to him and tell him where this individual was. And then he would literally kind of do a diagnosis of the person's problem. John Van Auken of the ARE calls him a psychic diagnostician, where you would tell him, here's the person, here's where they are, and Edgar would say, yes, I have the body. And then he would go on to describe what the physical problem was, and then he'd go on to describe a remedy if one actually existed, or if they needed to make one, or if it was already too late. And often Casey would say, well, here's the problem and here's the remedy, but this person is not motivated and is not going to do anything about it. And that happened from time to time. But the remedies that Casey gave have actually been tested by various researchers, physicians who tested it. And because it was 80-some percent accurate, generally the numbers that are given in the scientific studies are 83 to 88% accuracy.
Huge.
Yes, very high. But that doesn't mean the others were wrong. It just means they can't necessarily tell whether or not the remedy worked. There was no way for them to follow up.
True.
But because of that, Casey was actually dubbed by the American Medical Association in an editorial the father of American holistic medicine. Casey literally was the first person to come up with holistic medical practices in America. And a lot of the things that are done today came from Casey. It's amazing. It really is. So he had all this health stuff, and that's where he became famous. The New York Times called him a sleeping prophet. There was a medical association meeting in New York in 1910 where a group of physicians presented a paper about Casey at an American Medical Association meeting. The New York Times had a reporter there, and he was just enthralled with it, and he wrote an article and dubbed Casey a sleeping prophet. And from that moment on, Casey was inundated with letters from people trying to get help for their physical remedies.
All right. Now, how did Atlantis come up in some of these readings?
Well, that's a very interesting thing, too. That really popped up in 1923. Until 1923, the Edgar Casey's readings all had to do with essentially physical health. In 1923, there was a gentleman by the name of Albert Lammers who brought Casey. Actually, he took him several different places. Casey was actually professionally, he was a photographer. He was an award-winning photographer. He won some national awards from the Kodak company. But this Lammers literally brought Casey to several hotels, the Casey family, and without actually telling them what he was going to ask him, he started asking him what would be considered metaphysical questions. And it kind of blindsided everybody. But that is when, in 1923, is when Edgar Casey first mentioned Atlantis. It's also when most of these, almost all of the other metaphysical things about Casey, like past lives, the ancient history of the world, and that a lot of the people that were alive today had actually been intimately involved in that ancient history, which is, of course, reincarnation. And that scared him very much, but that's how it emerged. And a lot of this is really odd. The first mention, for example, of Bimini, which is a really tiny Bahamas island, it was odd. There was a group of people in Florida, businessmen, and this was in 1923, brought him to Florida to the Halcyon Hotel, and they were interested in developing Bimini basically to try and find oil there. And Casey said there is no oil there, but it's the highest portion of once a great continent. They didn't ask another question about it. That's exactly what he said. But this is the highest portion of what was once a great continent. And he meant Atlantis. Now, the next time, Casey mentioned that there was gold buried there, specifically 120,000 gold coins and silver, which actually would not be that unusual since that was all basically in the midst of pirate treasure areas. In the Bahamas, we know for certain that there was pirate treasure there. So they asked Casey where this treasure was, and he told them, and they tried to find it, and they couldn't. They then came back and asked him why, and he said their motives were not pure. And then they started asking him more questions about Atlantis.
And that's where we got some of these incredible stories.
Well, yes, we got that really started. Interestingly, the only Casey readings that are gone, that aren't there in their entirety, and there's roughly 14,400 readings. He's the only psychic probably who ever lived where virtually everything he said was written down and could be tested. Which is astounding if you think about it. There's 50,000 pages of readings at the ARE, all of which now can be accessed on the Internet, particularly for members, and it's very easy to do. But 50,000 pages. And imagine if a person went through life and everything they said was written down, and you could test it later A lot of us say things that turn out to not be true, and a lot of us give opinions about things that turn out to be wrong sometimes. But everything he said is there, and it's accessed by researchers. And he really opened himself up for a tremendous amount of scrutiny. But that's been very helpful for a lot of us. It's allowed us to take his readings and, for example, find every single thing he said about mounds. There's 68 readings on mounds. Everything he said about Atlantis, there's 700 readings which mention Atlantis. Everything he said, for example, about Peru, or everything he might have said about the Gobi Desert or pyramids there or Egypt. We can now pull all of those out through computer searches and then literally compile them, lay them out, organize them, and then test them, see how accurate they are. And that's what's being done.
How did he describe Atlantis, Greg?
He described Atlantis initially as an empire, a large empire extending basically from the Straits of Gibraltar all the way to the Gulf of Mexico. Some people have said that it was a solid mass of land, which is impossible. But Casey never said that it was a solid mass of land. What most of us believe that there were the sea levels we know were lower than. There were a lot of islands out there. Mm-hmm. He said that the Atlanteans actually lived their lives in ways very similar to what we do. They did have a totally different kind of a technology where they did use energy. They probably were the first green people on Earth. They were using the sun's energy to generate electricity almost exclusively, and they did it by focusing the rays of the sun using crystals. He also said they had certain kinds of flying ships. There's really no doubt about that, although it's that gets a little weird because he talks about them using what we would today call blimps or dirigibles. And they sounded somewhat primitive, and
it doesn't sound like high technology.
That wasn't high tech, but apparently they had a way to propel these using this crystal technology, and they could also communicate over vast differences. But other readings talk about devices which sound exactly like elevators, other kinds of aircraft, submarines. High-tech houses that had where people had energy. He doesn't say they had electricity with wires, but they had all kinds of appliances and things, and obviously those required some sort of energy.
It almost seems like a simple society with high-tech equipment, not the kind of equipment we use today. I don't think they had microwave ovens and things like that.
Right.
But, and they probably still lived in stone-type housing, but they had the ability to use electricity, like you said, harnessing it from the sun. Maybe they made batteries. Maybe they had things. So they had high technology in a very low-tech environment, I would say.
That's a really good way of putting it. If you think about it, on the Earth today, we have lots of countries where it would be very primitive.
It's like Star Wars. I mean, you look at their houses, right?
Yeah.
And they look like stone huts. Yet they've got flying ships and all these incredible things.
Mm-hmm. Well, stone is actually a very good building tool. If you want something to last, you build it from stone. And actually, there's a great series been showing about when people are gone. I think it's on the History Channel. And it really shows something. Edgar Evans Casey, who's Edgar Casey's grandson, who's still alive.
Yes.
I know you've had him on your show
before.
Yes.
As a matter of fact, I promoted his saying a discussion with Edgar Casey.
Yes.
Which is true.
Yes. Well, Edgar Evans has pointed out for years, and he did this actually back in the 70s initially, he said that a high technology is the easiest to destroy, and that if we sank an area of America where we have computers and automobiles and planes and other things, it's going to be gone in no time. There won't be a trace that can be found. And actually, our search of the Bahamas, we found a lot of things like planes that are just 20 and 30 years old, and they're almost totally deteriorated. The salt water.
Yeah, just eats away at
it. Yeah, it just destroys them. It's amazing how quickly tires can be destroyed. But a high technology is easy to destroy. Stone, on the other hand, does stand the test of time. The Great Pyramid, the other pyramids for that matter, they're made of stone. And they're actually in pretty darn good shape. They're not going to last forever, but they've certainly been there longer than the the building I'm in will be, or probably any building in the United States of America isn't going to last as long as the pyramids have.
What happened to Atlantis?
Well, both Plato and Casey pretty much agree on that, and Plato's story is relatively simple at the end. Plato said that when Atlantis ended, which was around 9600 BC, according to Plato, the Atlanteans had tried to conquer the world, particularly inside the Mediterranean, and that as retribution for their forgetting their connection to divinity or to God, that's actually in Plato's story, that's similar to Casey, and because they had their arrogance in trying to conquer the world, that something essentially came from the sky and destroyed them. That is very much what Plato said, and that they sank in a day and a night. Their main island sank in a day and a night. He called them an island empire also. Edgar Casey's story is slightly different. He doesn't tell us exactly what destroyed it, but he did say that certain portions of Atlantis, particularly in the mountains and so on, whatever was mountainous, and particularly the people who were very primitive, like the people who lived in the mountains or the people who lived on farms, and particularly in high land, that they watched as this disaster befell everybody else. And the lands near the water, the lands near the ocean, ports and so on, that those were all destroyed. And Casey doesn't tell us what it was, but it sounds like, from everything he said, a cataclysm from the sky. But again, Casey actually gave us a much longer history of Atlantis, and there were three destructions of Atlantis, according to Casey, whereas Plato only talks about the last one. But they both give the same ending date, around 10,000 B.C.
But they had some time to flee.
Casey was real specific. They fled three different times. One was 50,000 BC, or 52,000 years ago, which would have been a mind-boggling statement even 5, 6, 7, 8 years ago, even though we were saying it then. Now you're hearing, even here in America, that some mainstream archaeologists are arguing that there were people here as long ago as 50,000 years. And Casey did say that some Atlanteans fled to America 50,000 years ago in the first destruction. Some also went to South America. Some of them went to Egypt. Some of them went to the area between France and Spain, the Pyrenees Mountains, and others went to the Gobi Desert, which wasn't a desert at the time. Casey then says the second destruction was around 28,000 B.C., and again, the Atlanteans fled the same places, and the third and final destruction was in 10,000 B.C., and that's when large groups of people emigrated from the lands, and again, that goes back to where we started from, and that was this communication that this key priest got from some sort of intelligence, which every way you read it, it sounds extraterrestrial, and he even says it was from other worlds. Whether or not it would be like a visitor from another world, like a UFO, or it was something mental, I tend to look at it like it was some sort of a mental intelligence, mental communication that he got. It could be interpreted otherwise, though.
Absolutely. Well, when we come back, Rick, I want to talk with you about some of your work out there in the Bahamas and some of the discoveries that you've made. We'll also talk about the crop formations that you talked about with Andrew Collins and see what he has come up with. What's your website, Greg?
Well, go to www.edgarcasey.org. There's a special offer there for Coast to Coast listeners. It's right on their homepage, edgarcasey.org. And my site is mysterious-america.net.
Okay, we'll be back in a moment on Coast to Coast AM.